Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, or you can always find us on restaurantguysradio.com or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Pretty well. Pretty well. I love this time of year.
You know what I love? No, that's over. It's
oh.
Boom, boom, boom.
We need to stop now.
Really, really. We could dub that in later. New Year's Eve. Love New Year's Eve. Can I say something? New Year's Eve is one of my favorite nights to work.
I have to say, I don't like working Christmas Eve, although we had a great tradition, and we'll talk a little bit about. We had a great tradition at
We made the poll. People restaurant. Work on Christmas Eve.
No. Oh. Restaurant I used to work at, I worked a lot of Christmas Eves, and I hated working Christmas Eve, so I decided that I was going to absolutely make the best of it. So I talked to the owners of the restaurant, and they used to let us, everybody, all the regulars, could bring in one of their family's dishes. So if you were Hungarian, you brought in the Hungarian stuff.
And goulash is the word you're looking for.
But everybody brought in some ethnic cuisine from whatever their traditional Christmas Eve was.
Uh-huh.
And it was really cool because, you know, it weren't a lot of us. Maybe there'd be 20 or 30 people in the bar on Christmas Eve. But everybody brought, like, a sampling of their past. And, you know, it was really a fun way to do it. Now, truthfully, I want to be with my family on Christmas Eve. That's what I want to do. That's
right.
You know, more than anything. But before I had children, and you know, it was okay to spend a few years like this and fun, and it was great to, you know, a lot of people didn't have all their family close by, so they were able to kind of share in that at the same time. So they'd bring these we'd set up a table and basically we'd be open serving dinner until a certain time. And then dinner hour would end, and the restaurant would clear out. And once the restaurant was cleared out, people were allowed to bring in, you know, these little platters of food or trays of food, and really interesting and really nice, and I think very what Christmas is supposed to be about.
Well, you know, the New Year holiday, it does not have any of those same family connotations for many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
And the New Year's holiday is a time for couples to go out. Or I remember when I was a kid, New Year's Eve was one of the first bottles of wine that my parents let me have by myself.
I remember New Year's Eve was one of the first bottles of wine that I had, but it didn't have anything to do with my parents letting me have it.
Well, how old were you?
I'm going to say, like, for that we had wine, I'm going to say it was 16.
See, I was like 15, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I had wine at the dinner table and things like that, but
it wasn't until junior or senior year of high school that I started to go out on New Year's Eve. And I'd go out with people from work because we would work on New Year's Eve till the store closed. I worked in a ShopRite supermarket, and I had a lot of great friends there and some really interesting people, and we had a lot of fun. But the owners are Greek of the supermarket chain, and they would bring us ouzo, and that was just too much for
for a 15-year-old stock boy.
No, this is when I was older, when I was in college. It was the ouzo. But my parents went to a party, and they really wanted to go to this party, but they were concerned about leaving me alone. I'm like, oh, please, do not, please leave me alone, you know. And
well, see, my parents were concerned about leaving me alone, too, but maybe for a different reason than your parents.
Yeah, exactly.
About
I was
alone.
I wasn't going to have the entire you know, school over. And they set me up. I'm as I think about it, you're going to think I'm such a dork, because maybe I am, but they set me up.
Hold on. You don't need to tell this story.
They set me up on New Year's Eve in my parents' house. They went out to a party, and they were going to come home after midnight. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry. We'll be here with you for New Year's. I'm like, I don't want to be with my parents on New Year's. So they left me with I had some provolone cheese, some imported provolone cheese from Orange, where we're from. I had some antipasto.
You imported it from Orange?
I had some, no.
Because that's not very impressive.
The people in Orange imported it from Italy. And I remember it was a bottle of Lancer's Rosé. It was one of those little demi bottles of Lancer's Rosé. And
I worked at a restaurant that used to serve Lancer's Rosé.
And I thought, you know, I'd really like to be sophisticated and like wine, but I don't think I can do this very much. Good taste even then. It was okay. My
bottle, I will tell you, my bottle was a bottle of Black Tower. Do you remember Black Tower?
Oh, yeah, the German.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember the German Black Tower.
Black Tower. Was it German? I don't even...
It was. The Black Tower was a German QBA.
It was horrible.
Yeah, horrible.
Sorry, Black Tower
people. The commercials used to have a black opaque... It came in a black opaque bottle.
Black opaque bottle. That's exactly right.
And the commercials used to have it sitting in a stream with water running by it. And I'd rather have the water. It was really not very good. And I love German wines.
But we used to get together, and this was, I always think it's a good idea to not drive a lot on New Year's Eve. And,
yes.
We put a lot of people in a hotel across the street in our restaurant on New Year's Eve because it's that kind of a night.
Right.
You're going to go out. You're gonna overdo it. You know, it's a night to overdo it.
Or others might overdo it.
But I'm always more worried about me overdoing
it. I want to overdo it. I want to overdo it.
So it's a great night not to be around. So even as a young kid, we would go to somebody not too young, but we would go to a neighbor's house, and we would hang out there, and be able to talk to each other and have a neighborhood party, and everybody would walk home. You'd walk home at 2 or 3 in the morning, and you'd be 2, 3, depending on whose house it was at, you'd go home at 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And I did that through college. After college, it was always understood that if you had a party on New Year's Eve, you either had to be close enough for people to walk, or people were crashing at your house.
Okay, so let's turn the conversation to restaurants. We're adults now, and we have restaurants.
We are adults.
I will tell you that I have had 2 New Year's Eves off since I've been 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make great choices on either of those nights. One of the things that we've always striven for, and a lot of our colleagues in the restaurant...
Striven.
A lot of our colleagues... I took those SATs. I did pretty well. And a lot of our colleagues in the restaurant business, we have the same conversation about what are you going to do on New Year's Eve? Because some people feel sort of a lot of pressure to have a great time. And there's nothing that can impede you having a great time more than feeling like you have to have a great time or you've blown it, right? And, I think a lot of folks enjoy, if you enjoy, a big club, as many people as possible party, I guess New Year's Eve can work for you in a lot of venues. But I think sometimes it can be overhyped. And I think so you have to be careful to be sure that, there's fun stuff and the sense of bonhomie, the kind of sense of I don't know, you got to strike the right balance on New Year's Eve, or it can be a really big anticlimax. And I think that, we've done that. We did jazz concerts for a few years, and they did great. A woman named Jackie Naylor came and did jazz concerts. We had a big band with ballroom dancing for a while. We did that for several years. But you got to hit it right, and you can't overhype it, and it's just, it's like, having fun yet?
I'll tell you, and I really like what we're doing right now, and this is not a plug really for us, but, New Brunswick does this that Francis and I put on, this fireworks spectacular at midnight.
Presented by the restaurant guys.
Absolutely, and we have sponsors like Moet and other people like that who help us put this night on. But in the middle of downtown New Brunswick at midnight, there's a lovely, 10-15 minute firework display, and it's kind of a great way to celebrate the moment and feel the moment without saying, you got to be hammered, there are all these other, without all the other expectations.
Well, and I think that
I guess what I'm saying is try and find something to do, and it sounded like you were saying that, try and find something to do on New Year's Eve that doesn't have all the other expectations.
You
go to a show, you go to dinner, you go to a friend's house, whatever it is, make the night have its own interest. Don't try and create interest for the night because it's New Year's Eve.
I think an interesting contrast is I like some of the first night events that they have going on. I mean, those are kind of alcohol-free New Year's Eves. And if you have a family and you want to have an alcohol-free New Year's Eve, I think it's nice to come together with a community. New Brunswick, we have a lot of bars and restaurants.
Right, it's a restaurant community.
And, it's not alcohol-free. The event is alcohol-free. But the idea is that the whole community comes together on the street, rings in the new year with great hope for the future. I don't know, and I think we need a little great hope for the future.
I think we could use from. I'm ready for hope for the future. I got to tell you.
You have any things that you want to have happen in 2012, Mark? Any things you'd like to see have happen in 2012?
World peace. I'm all for it.
If you're running for Miss America, it's not gonna work. You know, I just hope that the sense of sort of returning, I mean, I hope that people who are in trouble get to be less in trouble. I hope that things loosen up for people, and I hope that the sense of normalcy that people are starting to feel again or to embrace again a little bit, at least in what we've seen around here in our dining rooms, I hope that continues.
It's really a better place that way.
Anyway, well, stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Randy Clemens. He has written, with Greg Koch and Steve Wagner, The Craft of Stone Brewing Company, an excellent new book about beer.
Hey, Randy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the Stone Brewing Company is an actual brewery, and I want to talk about the brewery, and it's a lovely book. How did you get drafted in to write this with the owners?
Well, I actually I pitched them on the idea. I'd been working on a cookbook that actually came out earlier this year, the Sriracha cookbook, all about the hot sauce. And after I'd wrapped that, I was kind of racking my brain of what I wanted to write about next, because I just had this fever to write more. And so I'd been in the beer industry for a couple of years, and not just drinking it, but also, you know, selling it and learning more about it and all that kind of stuff. So I'd sent a pitch to Greg, who's the CEO. Just late one night, I kind of got this eureka moment idea and put this pitch together to write a book about their history, knowing that Stone was coming up on its 15th anniversary, and, you know, just kind of fired it off after I drafted it about 3 o'clock one morning. And, you know, I said, okay, if I don't hear back from him in 2 weeks, you know, I'll follow up. And I woke up the next morning to a reply. He'd sent it like 6:45, and just saying he was interested in talking more about it. So I kind of got together with him and Steve, who's the president. They're both co-founders, and chatted with them more and got the ball rolling.
So Francis and I have been fans of Stone Brewing for a while and carried their IPA. And, you know, the Arrogant Bastard is a pretty famous beer name out there. But why Stone? Why was that the choice for this particular book?
Well, for me, I mean, I lived in L.A. at the time. I now live down in San Diego, which is where Stone is located. And when I was working, I worked retail for a number of years, selling beer and things like that. And just here in Southern California, Stone also distributes beer, not just their own, but other brands, other small breweries, and other craft breweries from around the country and from around the world. And it really spoke to me, just their kind of commitment to the cause, not just to their own beers, but to the craft beer industry as a whole. And I loved they were out there promoting other small businesses, trying to get them to market and trying to help support their beers as well. So I really liked that, and having gone down to the brewery for you know, several tours, and they also do a really, really big anniversary celebration where they also invite out tons of other breweries from around the world to pour their beers there. And it's just, they're really great events, and I just had a really great feeling about everything Stone was doing for not just themselves but for the industry, and it spoke to me, and I really loved their beers, and I also loved the food that was coming out of the restaurant, the Stone Brewing World Bistro and Gardens. So it kind of added up to be a perfect storm for me.
One of the reasons that we asked you to come on the show and we were so intrigued by the book is Stone is a perfect example of a particular kind of brewery. We hear a lot about microbreweries or brew pubs, very tiny operations. We, of course, know about the Budweisers and Coors of the world, which are very, very large, powerful operations that are mass market operations. And we also know about some small breweries who sort of became rather large breweries and are now contract brewed in several places and became more of a large brand that started as a microbrewery. Stone does a very good job occupying the market, whatever you want to call it, a small large brewery, or it's by no means an international conglomerate, but it is by no means either, you know, some little microbrewery where you know, everything is done on a small batch.
Yeah, that barely makes enough for themselves to use in their restaurant.
So one of the things that we found so intriguing about Stone is that they've kept the quality high. They've kept the size of themselves to what maybe a large-size American brewer pre-prohibition would have been in the United States. How have they done that, and is my analysis right on that?
Well, I think so. I mean, every drop of beer, every drop of Stone beer comes out of the same, you know, four tanks at our brewery in San Diego. We're looking to add an additional brew house to keep up with demand, but it's going to be in the same facility. I mean, we're doing a huge expansion that's going to be taking place over the next few years. It's grown at quite a clip. I mean, double-digit year-to-year growth every year. We're now looking at making about 150,000 barrels of beer this year, you know, and to put that in perspective, a barrel is 31 gallons, so two kegs. So we make quite a bit of beer, but we're in 36 states and Washington, D.C., and we export a very, very minimal amount of beer. But it's definitely still a small drop in the ocean, you know, as far as the global beer market's concerned. But it's just it's been a matter of making beer our own way. You know, Greg and Steve, their beers, and along with the brewmaster Mitch, they're brewing beers that they want to brew. They're brewing beers that they want to drink. There's going to be people out there that don't like them. I mean, the Arrogant Bastard Ale label will be the first to tell you that. But there's these beers that, you know, there are people that aren't going to like them. But for those who do, you know, they'll be certainly glad to find them, because there was such a long period of time where there was just this mass market. Greg calls it fizzy yellow beer. You know, he thinks it's dumbed down and just flavorless, and relies on the ad man to tell you want to drink it versus you actually wanting to drink it.
You know,
so
yeah,
you get
to ride in a big horse with if you in a beautiful carriage if you drink certain beers.
That's right.
You go to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, just the commitment to quality and not dumbing down beers and not looking at focus groups and not pandering to what we think the public wants, but just making what we want and what we like, and letting other people who enjoy that same flavor, that same quality, find us.
Well, and what is your Super Bowl commercial going to be in this year upcoming? Do you have that figured out yet, or is that still on the drawing board?
Stone has never advertised their beers. We relied strictly on word of mouth and the quality of the beer to sell itself. And it's, like I said, it's been the fastest growing craft brewery in the United States year to year. Over the past 15 years.
Hey, Randy.
Yes.
I knew that you guys weren't going to have a Super Bowl commercial.
I figured as much, and I appreciate you leading the witness.
So, all right. Now, one of the things that's interesting that is reflected in your book and also in dealing with Stone for a long time is, of, you know, in these four tanks that you have dedicated to beer, you churn out dozens and dozens of different kinds of beer, seasonal beers, you know, special collaboration ales. Wouldn't it be a hell of a lot easier to make like four or five kinds of beer and that be it?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it'd be a lot easier. It wouldn't be nearly as much fun, but it would be a lot easier. We've got 9 year-round beers that we do, and I believe, I want to say the number that we produced this year was 26 different beers. So 9 of those are the year-round selection. The rest were all just kind of fun projects. I mean, there are a certain number that we release once a year, special releases like the Stone Imperial Russian Stout, the Stone Old Guardian Barley Wine, Double Bastard Ale. These are, you know, special releases that come out at a certain time each year. The rest have been collaboration brews that we do with other small breweries. We just wrapped one that's going to be coming out on December 19th. It's called the Alchemist Ninkasi Stone More Brown Than Black IPA, and we did it with the Alchemist Brew Pub out of Waterbury, Vermont. They actually, their entire brewery was destroyed by Hurricane Irene. And so we got together with them. They're a very small brewery. I mean, I believe they're brewing something like 400 barrels a year, which is the amount that we brewed our first year of business. And Jamie Floyd from Ninkasi up in Eugene, Oregon. So they actually come to our facility and brew with our brewmaster to put together this recipe that otherwise would have never existed. You know, it's just kind of a fun little project. They get together, and it's kind of like their playtime. You know, they get to figure out a fun new beer to make. And actually all the proceeds from the beer are going to go towards the Waterbury Good Neighbor Fund, so it's going to go right back into the community that was destroyed by Hurricane Irene. So that kind of stuff for me is another reason I was drawn to Stone. It's not the first nor the last time they'll do that. I mean, the anniversary celebration, excuse me, the anniversary celebration I was talking about earlier, this year alone raised $250,000 for local charities. So there's just, it's a lot of really good stuff that drew me to Stone when I wanted to write my book.
That's great stuff. You know, especially Hurricane Irene information is near and dear to me, as my house was pretty well leveled by Irene. But one of the issues we deal with in the restaurant is we'll come up with some great dish, some great item on the menu, and then either the season changes or the something happens where an ingredient isn't as available, or we just decide we want to change the menu. Sometimes there's a backlash from our customers on those items when they disappear, especially if they disappear forever. Do you guys get backlash from the customers?
We get a fair amount of interesting emails in the inbox for sure. It's always interesting to watch the timestamp on them. As the later the evening goes, the more entertaining the emails can get.
I was calling you guys to say that your beer. Yeah, that kind of like later email kind of thing.
Certainly, we get a good share of those. But no, I mean there's plenty of people, you know, asking that we make a certain style of beer or that we make a certain beer year round. And as flattering as that is. There's so much to juggle. I mean, we're dealing with a live, living product, just as you guys are with in restaurants. You know, there's seasons. I mean, we're not as tied to seasons just because grain is available year round and things like that. But just the ability to work it into our production schedule and still be able to do all the things we want to do, it's tough. But we certainly get a number of emails asking for different beers to be made year round or to bring back other beers. There was a collaboration beer that we did with Dogfish Head and Victory Brewing Company a few years back, and we're actually going to rebrew that next year in 2012, so that's really exciting. It was one of my favorite beers. It was called Saison du Buff, and it was made with parsley and rosemary and sage, and so it was kind of this bouquet garni that was thrown into the beer, and it turned out great. I really, really liked it, and it's been pretty popular, and there was a little bit of arm twisting, and they're going to do another brew of it next year, so I'm looking forward to it.
You raise a great point. You know, in the restaurant business, we make things that are seasonal that march along with the seasons, and that's dictated by what grows out of the ground at what time, because we want stuff fresh. And, of course, we preserve fruits and serve them in the winter, but that's not the same as, you know, the fresh strawberries for the 6 weeks that we get them or the 4 to 6 weeks we get them in the early summer or late spring. Seasonal beers are not dictated by what's available because, as you say, most of the things that go into beer are stable and available through the year. They're dictated by this what you want to drink at different seasons. Is that fair?
It can be. I mean, our beers are. Greg is pretty adamant about their special releases. They're not tied to any season. I mean, so our Stone Imperial Russian Stout this year came out. Just as summer was beginning, and I mean it's a dark, thick, viscous beer. I mean it's not exactly a refreshing beverage in the middle of summer. I still enjoy it, but I definitely start drinking those heavier, darker beers more in the winter. I like them year round, but certainly, I mean, if you're looking to enjoy a beer with your meal, the stouts and porters and the darker, more hearty beers are definitely in season right now. This is one of my favorite times of year. I love the heartier cuisine, and I love the heavier stouts and porters, whereas in the summer I want something a little cooler and refreshing, and that's just going to match the food that I've got. So, yes, there is that. Stone likes to play by its own rules, but, as far as what I like to enjoy, certainly there are seasons where I'll dive into different styles a little bit more heavily.
Yeah, venison stew doesn't necessarily go as great with light pilsner.
Weizen.
No.
Now, just one final thing about the book, and it's a great little book. It's called The Craft of the Stone Brewing Company, Liquid Lore, Epic Recipes, and Unabashed Arrogance. You have a bit on home brewing in here. Why did you choose to include a section on home brewing in a book about a commercial brewery?
Well, I mean, just about every brewer who is out there, commercial or otherwise, started as a home brewer, and the book covers the very humble beginnings. As much arrogance as there is with Arrogant Bastard Ale, there actually are. It was actually a little touching to get to know the humble side of Greg and Steve and kind of their grassroots beginnings back in the early '90s when they started doing home brewing and formulating these recipes. And I think that's a big part of it. And Stone is really supportive of the homebrew community. We host a homebrewing competition every year in March, and the winner of that competition gets to come into our brewery and brew their beer with another brewer. It's one of the collaboration beers we do every year. I think it's a really cool experience. But, yeah, just keeping that ingenuity and that inventiveness alive with homebrewers. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, as we started talking about the book more and more, it grew in scope to cover a lot more than we'd originally planned. And I think that the project is that much better for it.
Hey.
What we were talking about earlier with beer and food pairings, that's covered in there too. But the homebrew recipes, I really fought to get some in there. Some of the like Stone Pale Ale, they didn't really want to give that one up. I mean, that was the beer that started it all. It's one of the flagship beers, and they didn't really want to share the recipe. But I said, look, you got to give me Stone Pale Ale or Stone IPA. I need one of the two in the book, and they finally caved and gave me Stone Pale Ale. So there's some good stuff in there, with some really, really fun recipes, some that are still in production, some of the collaboration beers I talked about, and some of the old anniversary ales that you can't get anymore. They existed once. And they're gone, but you can recreate them now.
Well, and while this is a great book overall, there's really cool stuff in here, and you have some beer expertise that we'd like to talk about on the other side. We've got to take a quick break, but if you stick with us when you come back on the other side, we're going to talk to Randy about a beer nog, which is appropriate seasonal thing to do with a beer just around the holidays. So stick with us. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest is Randy Clemens. His book is The Craft of Stone Brewing Company. He's an overall beer expert who contributes to publications regularly. And we want to talk about seasonal beers and seasonal things to do with beers. You have a recipe for something I had never seen before in this book, a beer nog.
Well, the beer nog's not in the book.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry, not in the book.
Right,
you,
that was
you
on
have
your
a
blog.
Recipe for something I've never seen that is on your
blog.
On your blog called a beer nog. What is a beer nog, brother?
Well, there's an old SCTV skit, you know, where they're drinking, you know, they're calling it beer nog, and I think it's just literally, you know, I think they're just drinking beer out of a carton. But it got me thinking about a different way to approach eggnog. You know, because it's typically got brandy or something like that added in, and I thought if I could do something with a darker stout, and I actually like to use Old Viscosity from Port Brewing Company down here in San Diego. But any real heavy dark stout can definitely be used, and you just whip up some raw egg yolks and raw egg whites separately, blend it together with some whipped cream. You really have to work in a lot of air, you know, and you mix it up with the beer and a little bit of spices, some nutmeg grated on top, and it's a really, really surprising drink. I mean,
you sure that's
really
not gross?
I'm positive.
All right.
I dare you to try it. But yeah, the recipe is on my website, and I'm happy to share it with you guys if you'd like to put it up for your listeners.
That's terrific.
I'm really
not one to let a dare go by either. So.
Well, and also because I have the recipe all queued up, and all I have to do is hit publish, and it turns up on the website, I was really hoping you were going to suggest something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, beer nog for the holidays. It was once a joke, now it's a reality. We're going to try it with Guinness right after the show is over.
So, Randy, why don't you give us the address for your blog, because there's something else I wanted to talk about that was on your blog not all that long ago.
Yeah, sure. It's randyclemens.com. Nice and easy, nice and attentive.
Randy, I learned something about you in doing the research for this show that was a little bit surprising, but we definitely have one thing in common. You are a raw milk advocate. You're a
Absolutely.
Fan.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we're having a lot of trouble in Jersey here trying to get raw milk legalized, and you're having some trouble out there in California as well, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. There's so, you know, my whole shtick with raw milk is, you know, label it, put a big giant warning sticker on it. That's fine. I like the freedom to choose. I don't like being told what I can and can't drink by someone who has no business being in my kitchen. And I really believe in the health benefit of raw milk. I really, you know, there's always a small chance there's going to be a rogue pathogen in there or something like that. But to be honest, I'm more of the idea of self-vaccination. The more I kind of expose myself to these things in low doses, the better my body's going to be able to deal with them versus artificially protecting myself in some plastic bubble.
And
we've come into some trouble here. There's a great dairy up in Northern California called Organic Pastures, and they recently had their milk recalled because there were a few people who got sick and said that they had consumed raw milk or raw milk products, and all the test results have come back negative, but their milk is still not back on the market. And it's just, it's troubling. And I would much rather have the freedom to choose. Again, for those who don't want to drink it, you've got plenty of choices out there. No one's shoving it down your throat, and I'm all for clear labeling and transparency. And if it's something you don't want to purchase, don't purchase it. But if you're someone like me who believes in the health benefits, who enjoys the flavor, and likes to have the milk the way nature intended, I like to enjoy that liberty.
I'm indeed someone like you in that regard. I also, you know, I don't even have a problem if you want to put a greater degree of regulation on the raw milk dairies than you're putting on the regular dairies, you know, in order to
right,
ensure
enhanced
people.
Testing, right, whatever
enhanced
you need
testing,
to.
You know, it's going to make it a little more expensive. We understand those types of things. But there's really no reason that raw milk shouldn't be available in the world.
A caveat to that, however, is in some state markets, the way that that big dairy has tried to keep raw milk off the market is to introduce onerous testing that is unreasonable and basically unable to pass, that pasteurized milk would never be able to pass. And applying those sorts of tests to raw milk under the guise of, well, it has to be safe, yet it's just an unpassable test.
Correct. Yeah, there was a recent incident of that, I believe last year, you know, and it was one of these bills that just passed completely under the radar, was not open to public input here in California, and they wanted the milk to pass less than 10 parts per million of coliform bacteria. Now, coliform bacteria can be pretty scary, but to be honest, I mean, it's everywhere. There is the one strain of E. coli, which is of the coliform family, that is of interest. You know, that's one that gets people very dangerously sick. But to be perfectly honest, 10 parts per million of any coliform bacteria is a very, very strict example, and it's not something that can be matched.
And you eat all sorts of food that has
right that
way
has
more than
much
that.
More than that. Yeah, I just wanted people to know, Randy. Sorry to kind of throw you a curveball with the raw milk discussion there, but I wanted people to know you weren't just a one beer pony. You know?
Yeah, we are on the raw milk bandwagon with you. And you know, go ahead.
I think it's great, and I don't mind the curveball at all. It's something I'm thrilled to talk about. I'm all for food in its natural state. You know, it's the same. It is the same with the beer. I mean, Stone's beer is made without any chemical preservatives or adjuncts. You know, cheap filler like corn and rice, which can be used a lot of times. It's unpasteurized. You know, so I think it's served in its most natural state. And if anyone out there wants to view a really, really interesting documentary, it's called Farmageddon, and it touches a lot on the problems with legislation and raw dairy. And if you really want to see where some tax dollars are being misappropriated, you can take a look and just see the kind of surveillance they have on these small family farms that just goes way overkill and way out of bounds, in my opinion.
Yeah, if you want to see where tax dollars are being misappropriated, the Farm Bill is probably a good place to start.
It's a scary place to start.
And then finally, I just want to ask people to look back in our archives. It was a show we did a long time ago. It was a wonderful show with a homeopathic physician, a guy named Ron Schmid, who is an advocate for raw milk around the country. And he's a really smart guy, and there's a lot of inaccurate accusations leveled at the guy. But he's really smart. If you read his books or you listen to what he has to say on our show, you can go check the archives at restaurantguysradio.com.
All right, Randy, one last question about beer. There's kind of a cool thing that's going on out there where people are taking fine beers and distilling them into spirits. Does Stone have any sights on doing something like that?
You know, it's funny you should ask. I was just with Greg about a week ago, and someone kind of pulled him aside and asked me the exact same question. So I have a great answer for you. Our answer is no. You know, there's no real plans at the time right now. I mean, there are. So Rogue up in Oregon is making great distillate of their Dead Guy Ale. And I know Ballast Point down in San Diego is doing some distillation. Anchor is doing some distillation. I don't know that they're distilling their beers, but, you know, it seems to be a very interesting thing. There was a product on the market a few years ago called Beer Schnapps, that I believe was somehow affiliated with Sierra Nevada. Don't quote me on that, but I think so. And I got to taste it, and it was really interesting to see how the hop flavor was able to come through. But to make a long story endless, no, you know, Greg is very much a beer guy. I mean, he enjoys a fine wine once in a while and fine spirits once in a while, but it's just not something he's got that same passion for. And I think he's kind of leaving that to people who are that passionate about it. You know, he's not trying to fill a market niche. If he had that same drive and was really interested in it, I don't doubt for a second he'd go for it, because once he's got his mind set on something, no one can stop him. I mean, he's quite a force.
Randy, it's been lovely to have you on the show. We're going to post your recipe for beer nog up at restaurantguysradio.com. Check it out just in time for the holidays. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Randy.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on Restaurant Guys Radio and Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Raw Milk. We turned the beer show into Raw Milk. How did you do that? That was great.
It's not my fault, too. The guy's got rights about a lot of different things.
He does. He does.
And I caught on to it. I caught one little article that he did for 15 minutes, and I jumped on it.
You know what happens to raw milk? You know what happens to your milk when you leave it in the refrigerator too long and it goes bad? It gets all sour and separates, and it stinks, and you have to throw it out.
That stinks.
You know what happens to raw milk when it goes bad? Turns into yogurt. That's it. Turns into yogurt.
It's not quite, but close.
No, exactly. It turns into
if it spoils the right way.
Yeah, but I mean, most of the time, raw milk just becomes yogurt, and I think that's indicative of something
we're doing it wrong.
Something that it has.
There's one more thing we're doing wrong.
So what you do with or you can make cheese out of it, but what you need to do with pasteurized milk is you need to then inoculate it with the bacteria that turns it into yogurt. What? I don't get that. And
we're
just
doing it wrong. I get it. We're doing it wrong.
I'm a big raw milk fan, and it's tasty and delicious.
It is
and
so good. I mean, I know that some of you are new listeners and some of you are long-term listeners. Go back and listen to some of those the shows where we talk about raw milk. They're really interesting, and raw milk has lots of health benefits that kind of are getting swept under the rug and spun out in a centrifuge and, you know, smashed into oblivion.
All right. We got you're done now. You know what? Watch big agriculture, because one of the things that big agriculture often does is they project themselves as being champions of healthy food, and they try to portray small grower food, artisanal food, that's a charged term these days,
as dangerous.
As being dangerous. What you want is, you know, Velveeta is safe. We know Velveeta is safe, okay?
For hundreds and hundreds of years.
You know why? Because no bugs want to eat it. There's no food in the food. Okay, yeah. I'm exaggerating there, but a little bit. But, you know, everything, very, very processed, sterilized food is very safe. But often when you hear big ag talk about passing stringent safety regulations that small farms often can't manage to follow, what they're talking about is, like, there was a whole movement of people who wanted to irradiate meat, for example. Well, the reason that big ag wants to irradiate your meat is so that they can be less careful about keeping your meat clean and keeping the parts of the animal that you don't want in contact, what was inside the animal that you don't want in contact with the meat, from getting in contact with the meat. Because you know what? If there's too high a fecal load on meat without the irradiation, you're going to have a problem, and people are going to get sick, and you're going to have to recall your beef. If things are dirty and you irradiate it, it doesn't matter. And, you know, so often
they're still dirty, they just won't kill you anymore.
Right, and I don't care whether it's irradiated or not. I'd rather have clean food. And so just be careful when Big Ag talks to you about how they're coming out on championing safety, and why we need to buy from big producers is because of safety and cleanliness, because it's often just the opposite of what they're saying. Hey, listen, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com.